From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruriak. California's governor has ordered most of its 360 National Guard troops back from the Mexican border. His office says that tomorrow, in the governor's State of the State message, he will say the border emergency is a manufactured crisis and California will not be part of this political theater. Last week, New Mexico's governor, Michelle Grisham, recalled most of her state's troops from the border. She called the original deployment order border fear-mongering. And that original order for the deployment of 4,000 troops from four different states had been issued by President Trump in April of 2018. So let's start with this story in my weekly conversation with the political junkie Ken Rudin. He joins us from the Washington, D.C. area. Hello, Ken.
Good morning, Beth.
So what does it say to you that two governors out of the four states involved are pushing back now on this order?
Well, I think let's talk more about Gavin Newsom. The fact is that he, and it's interesting that what he's doing basically by pulling back the California National Guardsmen, he's basically reversing,
and women, of course, he's reversing
what Jerry Brown instituted last year in his final year in office. Of course, Jerry Brown didn't want to be part, you know, said that the National Guardsmen and women would not be part of the erecting of the wall. But basically, that what he's doing is reversing not only what Brown did, but he's basically reversing what Donald Trump has done. And basically, as he says in a State of the State message, that it's a manufactured crisis, it's political theater, and he just doesn't want to be part of it.
You know, there have been a lot of issues and ways of conducting state business where the past governor, Jerry Brown, and the current governor, Gavin Newsom, might be in alignment. But this is one that the new governor made no secret of, that he disagreed with Jerry Brown on this decision. And he'd been exploring the options. So for him to take a step right now and to pre-publicize the State of the State message, I think, is completely in line with what he said he was going to do.
That is true, but I don't really think that he and Jerry Brown are that far apart on their feelings about the border wall and the border security and the $5.7 billion that Trump is asking for Congress. I think the fact is just that Newsom, in a sense, just like Jerry Brown was a national leader on immigration and climate change and things like that, I think Gavin Newsom feels the same way about himself, perhaps even more progressive as the opposition to President Trump as we approach 2020 gets even stronger and more bolder or more bold. It wouldn't be more bolder, right? Because that would be bad Englisher, right?
Bolder, right, is
yeah,
better.
That would be better than more bolder, wouldn't it? Yeah. I think more bolder sounds like a plan in Colorado, maybe.
There you go. Now you're into the arena of Ken Rudin jokes. Gavin Newsom is saying that he wants to refocus these National Guard troops on the real threats facing our state. So to that end, he wants to move troops to support wildfire prevention and suppression efforts. He wants them to deal with counter-drug task force if there's funding of that expansion and targeting drug cartels. He says those are real challenges in the state and the border issue is not. And there were similar statements made by New Mexico's governor. Let me take you back to the first question that I asked. Two out of the four governors are saying we oppose this and we're pulling our troops back immediately. On the same day, in the same week as the 2020 campaign officially gets underway for President Trump, he's holding his first rally of the year tonight. Is this a bigger statement?
No, I think it's a major statement. Look, nobody, I mean, aside from the president's strong defenders and followers, and perhaps some Republicans in Congress, nobody sees the border wall as really the kind of emergency that the president is talking about. I mean, the rally that the president is going to have today in El Paso was talking about how the wall would end all that terrible crime going on in El Paso. But El Paso is not seen as a dangerous city. Matter of fact, it's seen as a pretty safe city. So for Newsom to talk about a manufactured crisis, in many ways it is. It's what Donald Trump has promised from the moment he announced his candidacy, the moment he took that escalator ride down in Trump Tower in New York and said basically that we're going to stop the crime and drugs and, you know, these terrible people coming in from Mexico. That's what Trump has done. That's what he's done to solidify and energize his base. And now that, you know, as this is coming, as more and more Democrats are running for president, announcing their candidacy for 2020. I think what Newsom is doing is basically telling the president that he's on notice, that this is not the kind of policy that the, at least the Democratic Party could support. And let's remember that the people in the National Guard report to and are directed by the governor of each state. So they really, unless the president federalizes the National Guard, what Gavin Newsom is doing is not a political stunt, and he has complete right and legal ways of doing it.
So Texas is another of the states involved. Texas hasn't moved its troops, but you mentioned El Paso. When President Trump is there tonight, there will be an opposing rally. I know you've seen this news by Texas Congressman Beto O'Rourke, who isn't
right, former congressman, right?
Or he isn't officially in the race for president yet, although there's been discussion of that. He's also going to lead a march through the city. So Texas is going to be the focus of this border conversation, as well as just opposing views on the administration overall.
Oh, that's no question about that, because, of course, the governor, the lieutenant governor, the attorney general, all statewide officials in Texas are Republican, very strong pro-Trump Republican, and along with Senator Ted Cruz, they support the president with his fight for the border wall. Beto O'Rourke, the guy who gave up his House seat last year to run for the Senate against Ted Cruz, narrowly losing, he, as you say, is a possible potential presidential candidate for 2020. He's from El Paso. So the fact that it'll be interesting to see, you know, how we have these split screens on television.
Right.
It'll be interesting to watch the kind of rally that Trump has in El Paso and the kind that Beto O'Rourke will be part of as well.
Governor Gavin Newsom's State of the State message is planned for 11 a.m. in the West tomorrow. Cap Radio and KQED will have live coverage right here. Now let's jump more into that conversation about the expanding presidential field. It grew by two over the weekend on the Democratic side. No surprises there. Senator Elizabeth Warren and Senator Amy Klobuchar jumping in. So what's the count now, Ken?
Well, the count, I count nine. There are two other people. There's a tech executive by the name of Andrew Yang, and there's a self-teaching author named Marianne Williamson. So if you want to include them, that comes 11. But you have five senators. You have a congresswoman from Hawaii. You have Julian Castro, the former mayor of San Antonio. You have the mayor of South Bend, Indiana. I mean, so you have basically anywhere between 9 and 11 Democrats already running. This is probably going to be the largest Democratic field since 1976, when Jimmy Carter won the nomination. And as we say, we still don't know about the killer bees, Biden, Beto, and Bernie. We're still waiting for them to make announcements. Plus, there's Sherrod Brown, the senator from Ohio, John Hickenlooper, the former governor of Colorado. So this field is not over. But when you have Amy Klobuchar and you have Elizabeth Warren, yes, they're both women. Yes, they're both U.S. senators, but they represent two different visions for the Democratic Party. I think Elizabeth Warren is much more, I would say, I don't know if progressive is the right word, but more willing to battle with the president, certainly on economic issues, where Klobuchar from the beginning has talked about her ability to work across party aisles, party lines. Yes, she's a liberal, but yes, she's not as confrontational. And of course, that is the debate going on within the Democratic Party, how to take on President Trump in 2020. Do you battle him all the way, or do you talk about, you know, more you know, bipartisan efforts? So that the weekend's events with Warren and Klobuchar shows that divide.
So in your last few minutes, you didn't say the name Kamala Harris. And for the past 3 weeks, since she jumped into the race, there was a lot of talk about Kamala Harris. Does she get moved a lot farther down the talking points of this race now with Warren and Klobuchar in?
Oh, no, I don't think so at all. Matter of fact, I mean, she's at the very, very top of the race. We're, of course, talking about Klobuchar and Warren because they're the last ones to make it official. But Kamala Harris, one, has star power, the ability to raise a lot of money, comes from a state with a lot of delegates. And, of course, one of the early states in the whole process. By the way, it's a year from today exactly a year today is the New Hampshire primary. Right. But a few weeks after that is California on March 3rd, 2020. Before that is South Carolina with its large treasure of African-American voters. Kamala Harris is at the very top of the prospective candidates for 2020.
What are you watching in her campaign? I know you're seeing different forums, different statements, certainly a different side of her at times than we see in the Senate hearings and in her more investigator, questioneering role. But give me more about your observations.
Well, you know, something like with every Democrat, you know, the media will pick and choose what they want to focus on, what they want to attack. There was a very deep article, I think it was in the New York Times. I don't even know if it was today or not, because I've been reading so many things. But basically, the different kind of Kamala Harris, as we've seen over the year, more of a liberal San Francisco district attorney who wanted to abolish the death penalty. But then when she was state attorney general, she was more of a law and order type that a lot of progressives weren't fans of. But you know something, with all these candidates and waiting for more to come in, I can't say I'm looking for anything until June, and we still have to, 4 months before June. Mm-hmm. And basically in June is when the debates start. And I think then we'll start picking the wheat from the chaff, as they say, because we'll see which ones can raise money, which ones can excite a crowd, and which ones can hold their own in a debate. And again, that's one of the reasons I have Harris on the very top, because she's shown to be capable of doing all three things.
I'm talking with Ken Rudin, the political junkie. Over the last week, we've talked on this program about the California delegation overall on Capitol Hill, Ken, and how this is a time, a standout time in history for power in leadership roles, power across a number of not only committees, but subcommittees, and a power that could be fleeting, that might not last more than 2 years or so.
Well, look, you know, 2 years is a lifetime in politics. If I were California, I would be very happy of the role they have with Nancy Pelosi as Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy as the House Minority Leader. Adam Schiff will be looked at very, very closely with his role as chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, given all the investigations going on with President Trump. Of course, Dianne Feinstein is the ranking Democrat on the Senate on Judiciary. And while Kamala Harris may not be in the Senate too long because she'll be out campaigning a lot, all eyes are definitely on the role that Californians play. And again, if I had to say anything, think of all the memes that have come out since the State of the Union regarding Nancy Pelosi and her clap, you know, her sarcastic clap directed at the president. Between Pelosi and Adam Schiff, they're going to be in a lot of the headlines. Whatever comes out on Capitol Hill this year, a lot of it will be about investigations, and Pelosi and Schiff will probably lead the way.
Okay, let's wrap this up just with a nod to Virginia. And the story out of there this morning is that there was discussion of articles of impeachment being pursued against the lieutenant governor. That seems to be in limbo right now. I think a lot of this will come back to, as you and I discussed before, what's in the Virginia Constitution? What is actually doable or not in that state?
Well, I think the bigger political part is that if you look, there's Governor Ralph Northam who says he dressed in blackface in 1984. The Attorney General is Mark Herring, who also said he appeared in blackface. The Lieutenant Governor is Justin Fairfax, who is African-American and who has two sexual assault allegations directed at him. So I think there's a lot of feeling that do we just impeach the lieutenant governor, and how would that look? The one African-American, we get rid of him, but we don't get rid of Northam and Herring. So I think a lot of things have to weigh out. But I think ultimately, I think whatever you think of, look, I'm not excusing blackface. I'm not excusing any kind of racist actions in the past. But the allegations against Fairfax seem to be much more concerning, much more serious. And I think they don't want to go after him. They'll wait for the process to go on and play itself out. But right now, all three are in very tenuous grounds. The worst possible week Virginia Democrats have ever had in their history.
Well, and polls on the issue, regardless of what the specific allegations are, polls are almost dead even about what to do in the state. So when you look to the electorate and you look at where the, you know, guiding citizenry opinion is, it's a split right now.
It is, but I also noticed that in those same polls, 58% of African Americans in Virginia say that they don't want Ralph Northam to resign. The fact that as reprehensible as appearing in blackface was, he has a history of working with the black community, with working for civil rights. So it's a very complicated look. It's not simple. I'm not excusing anything, but it's quite complicated. And I think that it's, you know, I mean, if you asked me a week ago, I would say that Northam was certain going to leave, but that looks no longer like the case anymore. Northam says he's not resigning. Herring saying he's not resigning. And Fairfax says he's not resigning, depending on what happens from this investigation. But right now, you know, basically the Republicans in Virginia seem to be licking their chops, and they have state legislative elections in November. And if all three Democrats remain there, it's going to be very tough selling the electorate, saying that, you know, we should elect Democrats to the state legislatures when we have people like Northam, Fairfax, and Herring staying in office.
Okay, Ken, that's a lot of big stories already just to start the week. It's still Monday, isn't it?
Yeah, I bet you if I were on your show tomorrow, we would have 10 more thousand things to talk about.
I know. All right, Ken, thank you very much. Glad to have you with us.
Okay, enjoy the state of the state.
Yeah, tomorrow's Insight, by the way, will be a preview of the state of the state, which you then can hear live at 11 o'clock in that partnership between KAP Radio and KQED. You're listening to Insight on KAP Radio.